This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 58 was recorded on Monday, September 16th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Dr. Pippa Malmgren is back. And Pippa, it's so good to be speaking to a geopolitical consultant because I got to tell you, I was caught wrong-footed today, Monday, which will be yesterday by the time our listeners hear this, when I saw the explosion in time spreads on WTI crude oil futures. I thought, okay, the world is panicking, thinking we're about to have a war with Iran and missing the news, which is that the Houthis in Yemen already admitted that they did it. In fact, they're threatening to do it again. I thought clearly this has to mean that the fears of all-out war with Iran are going to de-escalate. This price trend is a panic move that's going to retrace, and I want to short it. Well, just as we were about to get on this call, I was stopped out of that trade at a considerable loss because it seems that the Trump administration is very insistent that even though someone else has already confessed that, no, Iran did it, and we really need to look at what our policy is going to be with Iran. Help me understand this, Pippa. You are a geopolitical expert. How in the world is it really true that the Houthis are just pretending it was them and Iran really did this, even though it seems like evidence suggests otherwise? Help me sort this out.
Well, let's step back for one second and understand that what we're witnessing here is something that I know you and I have talked about before, which is the democratization of the airspace. And what drones are permitting is ever more players to enter this arena with very high-powered weapons that can be projected very, very long distances. And I think this is the beginning of a trend, so much so that I'm writing my next book about this subject. And it does change the nature of warfare. It used to be that only governments and space agencies could really afford to have command and control of airspace. You know, and let's face it, the whole last 100 years, wars have been totally driven by and won on the basis of air power. But now it's really democratizing. So this is an early symptom of a much broader phenomena. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, the way this administration looks at things is that there's Iran, and then there are all of the organizations in various parts of the world that Iran finances, supports, uses as a front, a face. In other words, the way this White House looks at the picture is the Houthis are just a proxy for the Iranians. It's the same, in their view, it's the same crowd. So it doesn't matter that the Houthis say, oh, it's us. Their view is, well, of course. It's like, you know, when you're dealing with the mafia and the leader doesn't say, I knock the guy off. It's some junior guy who works for you. It's a similar kind of assessment. So it won't protect us from the outcomes that you were fearful of and that you had assumed wouldn't happen. The next thing is, again, what's the backdrop? The backdrop is we have a very tight alignment now between the president and the Saudis, frankly, between the Saudis and the Israelis. And so there's an interest in taking advantage of such a moment, you know, which is not insignificant. I mean, the hit is on the most important facility for oil anywhere in the world, right? And Abqaiq has been the flashpoint for decades. This is not a new potential target. This is the one that has always worried everybody in the world of geopolitics. And they didn't only hit it. They hit it very, very precisely. They hit very particular buildings with very particular capabilities, and they did it several times, not just one. So this implies a degree of precision that, again, will cause the White House to presume that this is not non-state actors. This is non-state actors with a state behind it. So therefore, yeah, we're going to see a lot of alignment and this be used as a reason to have a much harder line on Iran. But by the way, the Iranians' view will be that they've got the president where they want him. They've now hurt him by pushing the oil price up. And I fear that their view is a very old one. It's kind of a 1970s view that if the oil price goes up, it hurts the leader of the United States. in the current environment, I'm not sure that's true. In fact, having worked in the White House, I could easily make the case that it will work massively to the president's advantage if he goes into this next election with a state of emergency, and especially one that he didn't declare, but he was forced to by circumstances. So that's another way of looking at this complicated puzzle.
Pippa, help me understand the motive that Iran would have had, assuming that they actually are behind this. It seems to me that John Bolton was just fired because he disagreed with the president when the president said, hey, it's time to start thinking about lifting or easing sanctions against Iran. Why would Iran take this action or cause someone else to take this action when the U.S. was apparently just about to maybe make some concessions for them?
Well, that's a lot of speculation. And I think that, you know, the press has drawn certain conclusions from John Bolton's departure that I'm not sure are correct. Their view was because Bolton has left, the administration is less hawkish. I don't think that's true at all. I think they're just as hawkish as they ever were. And probably the disagreements between Bolton and the president have more to do with, you know, egos and, you know, whose idea was it? And that kind of a clash rather than a substantive clash. You know, some presidents you have substantive disagreements with. This one, I don't think that's probably what's in motion. So I'd say the administration wasn't necessarily going to move to a softer position. And remember, we've had many months now of the Iranians being aggressive around the Gulf and the Gulf states with the tankers. They've generally speaking amped up the need for the regional partners of the United States to be much more vigilant than usual. They've threatened British nationals and British assets. That's viewed as, again, you know, you might not throw your punch at the United States, but you throw it at the kind of little brother. And that's viewed as just as egregious. So what I see is an environment where we've had a steady escalation of confrontation between Iran and various proxies for the United States at various levels, and it has only accelerated in recent months.
Let's talk about what comes next, because if we look at the market reaction, this is, I believe now, the biggest sudden overnight gap-up reaction ever. Even the Gulf Wars, the first day of the Gulf Wars that happened over the weekend, didn't result in as big of a percentage gain in crude oil on the open. And we're now seeing follow-through. Today, as we're speaking, we're not quite into the pit close yet, but all indications are that we're going to move even above the high in oil prices that occurred on the panic spike at the open on Sunday evening. And at least as the tape looks, as we're recording this, which is about 1:30 p.m., about an hour before the pit close on Monday, it looks like we're headed toward what I would interpret from oil traders' perspective as an indication that the market is discounting a coming war. This is not just a chance or a risk or maybe something to be concerned about. It seems to me that the market is reacting as like, okay, it's game on, baby. Is that the way you would evaluate this situation? And what do you think comes next?
Right. Well, so first of all, you know, one way of looking at this is that in retrospect, a decade from now, the Saudis will, I don't want to say be grateful for this moment, but the fact is a lot of that infrastructure was very old. And now there's a reason to upgrade it. And the fact is, getting oil out of the ground in Saudi is not very difficult, right? This is not like the North Sea where it's really expensive to pull oil out of the ground. This is a part of the world where, I'm exaggerating, but you pretty much just have to put a hole in the ground and you're there. So the question is, really, what is the damage to the capacity to deliver that's been generated by this event? And I would argue that the recovery time will be less than people think. It gives the Saudis an excuse to upgrade the infrastructure and to further reinforce and protect it. The risk is that these parties use these highly precise remote control drones again, which would be, you know, absolutely, we should assume that. And then the question is also, what other targets might they go after? How systematic might they be about the targeting process? But the reality is, of all the places in the world that you could damage, this is the one where infrastructure probably accounts, has the least relative value. You know, you hit something in the North Sea, that's the problem, because that's really expensive to rebuild that stuff. But this is a little different. The other thing is, what's the nature of war in the current, really in the modern technology environment? Is it really a kind of boots on the ground situation like the Gulf War? I think not. I think that what we've been watching with Iran for some time is a very high grade technological war, some of which is not even visible to the general public. And to my mind, that it didn't begin, but maybe the first visible moment of this, the first glimpse that we all had of this silent, invisible technological war was when the Iranian nuclear reactors began to slow down, because somebody, and there are lots of speculation who, but somebody from the West or someone aligned with the United States managed to get software into their, basically their nuclear testing lab, and faked them out so that they thought that the systems were all working properly, and they couldn't understand why it wasn't generating the nuclear material that they expected. And it took them like 6 months to work out that actually the data they were reading was wrong. And so the end result was everything was accomplished that the West would have wanted. They slowed down the nuclear program. They prevented Iran from synthesizing the nuclear material that they had been intent on achieving. And yet, you know, this is only known well in retrospect. And the public doesn't even really have a grip on what happened here. In other words, we're in a period of history where you can fight your wars using software bugs. You know, this is a different time. It's a different time. And so when we talk about war, I worry much more about things like American or British or Western nationals being taken when the Iranians seize, for example, some kind of a cargo ship that's in their shipping lanes. That, I think, is a bigger trigger. But even that leads to lots of diplomatic negotiations. It doesn't lead to boots on the ground. So I think that, yes, the market is panicking because they misjudged. I think they're underestimating that actually this could work to the president's advantage. And they are overestimating the risk of the old-fashioned kinetic war kind of confrontation and underestimating how much you can do with some tricky software.
Pippa, let's talk about what happens next in terms of military conflict risk. And specifically, obviously, our listeners understand this is the first day of this crisis. You and I don't have the specific intelligence data to know what the White House is responding to. But I want to talk about a different aspect of this, something I know you do know quite a bit about, having worked in the White House and having advised the United States president in your past career. Forgive me for sounding like a conspiracy theorist, Pippa, but it seems to me that in an election year, war is not a bad thing for the president of the United States. It kind of brings the people together to rally around, hey, in the interest of patriotism, we got to back the president because we're at war. Is it possible that that could influence the decisions that are being made in the White House and help to encourage a more military conflict-oriented outcome as opposed to a diplomatic resolution to this situation?
Listen, anybody who has watched The West Wing understands that any event is thought of in terms of its impact on the next election. It doesn't matter what it is. Any event at all are all seen through the prism of what does this mean for the upcoming election? Now, I would never argue that this president or the White House has in any way deliberately provoked this. But I would say, if I were sitting there in the West Wing, that this particular election, the president is definitely standing on a much more hard line, you know, America's tough kind of platform than any of his opponents are likely to. And now, if there's reason to be tough, and this event certainly does provide reason, will this rally his supporters? I think it will. It'll create an environment where the Democrats have to come up with a policy stance. What is their position on this issue? And it's a really tricky one because almost no other political leaders in the United States are as keen to be as closely aligned with the Saudis as the president is. And because he's chosen that spot and he kind of owns that territory. My view is that actually this could be surprisingly helpful to him during this next election. The other thing too is, you know, back to this fundamental point of what is the nature of war in the modern environment, it doesn't have to be a boots on the ground kind of situation. It can be a lot of rhetoric, a lot of positioning, a lot of building alliances, but not actual physical retribution or direct conflict between military personnel. But that doesn't mean that you can't act or that you can't do effective things. It just means that the risk of the kind of old-fashioned war that the markets are worried about maybe isn't so high. And the possible beneficial outcomes for the president are higher than people think.
Let's talk about what it would mean if there is a war with Iran. It seems to me that there's one argument, which is, hey, Iran doesn't have a lot of friends here, and Iranian oil is already pretty much sanctioned to the point where very little of it is still being exported on the black market. But, you know, if that were to come offline because of a war, it wouldn't make that much difference. Therefore, you could come to a conclusion which says, yeah, just not that big of a deal in terms of markets and the economy, despite the fact that it's obviously a humanitarian loss if there's a war of any kind. The other argument is, what if Russia takes Iran's side and this escalates beyond a U.S.-Iran conflict into a U.S. versus Iran backed by its friend Russia? Is that a risk here? And how would you see this playing out in terms of who might be allies of Iran that could come into the fold if this escalates to full-on military conflict?
Well, let's face it, Iran and Russia have been aligned for some time. That would not be new. And frankly, the Chinese and Iran are pretty tightly aligned. I think China is the biggest buyer of oil, both from Saudi and Iran. And they will also exercise a voice on this. But for a long time, there's been an alignment between the Russians and the Iranians that has been a sore spot for everybody else in the region, for, you know, Washington. And that was true under previous presidents as well. That's not that new. This is another reason why I think that it's not very likely that you end up in any kind of a physical, kinetic, traditional military conflict, because it would potentially draw in the superpowers. And I've argued for some years, actually, that it is a little bit like the 1960s, when people talked about the domino effect and this idea that, you know, if one country went communist, then one's next door would follow. And the danger was that this would draw in the superpowers. And so we were having proxy conflicts in places like Vietnam and Cambodia that never escalated into a direct confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, but kind of everybody knew, you know, who was playing which side in that moment of history. We could be in a very similar environment where what we're witnessing is a lot of proxy fights, a lot of proxy arguments, and it looks like it's the two local players. Like, it looks like it's, you know, Saudi and Yemen, or it looks like it's, you know, Iran and Saudi. But in fact, both have major superpowers that are involved as well. And none of those superpowers want to be in a direct confrontation. It's much more comfortable to do it through these proxies and in ways, again, that the public doesn't really see. I mean, you know, the public has not really been so closely following the news about the war in Yemen, which has been going on for quite a long time now. You know, it doesn't get onto the breakfast table of your average American. So you can have a proxy punch up that lasts a long time, even though the superpowers have a stake in the outcome. So again, I'm trying to make the case that escalation to, you know, a more Hollywood kind of version of war, I don't see it. I don't think our military commanders think that it would be smart or sensible. But that doesn't mean that we aren't having confrontation. It's just occurring through third parties and in quieter, less visible ways than ever before.
And obviously, the big question about China's involvement is China's already got an agenda with the U.S. So do you think that this situation with Iran is going to derail or further damage the negotiations that are ongoing between China and the White House? And what would the potential outcome be there?
Yeah, I mean, definitely China, they tend to remain very, very quiet because they don't like anybody criticizing their geopolitics. So their view is we won't step into anybody else's. But that doesn't mean that they don't have a view. And they, on lots of issues like this, they'll weigh in carefully and obliquely. This is not their idea of a great outcome. They do not want to see conflict escalate. You know, on the other hand, I don't think it's outrageous to point out that, you know, we live in a world today where most of these major countries have turned to arms sales as a major source of revenue. And I argued for the last decade that we're seeing a massive increase in military defense spending and in the proliferation of particularly smaller arms all over the world. And who's in that game? Well, the Chinese are manufacturing. They are weapons manufacturers now, but so are the Germans, the Americans, the British, the French. You know, lots of nations are ramping up their weapons production. So do they have an interest in, let's say, a buying community? Yeah. And so this is why I've really been very focused on small arms sales ever since I wrote that book, Geopolitics for Investors, back in 2015. And I think there's only been escalation since then. So you can have a situation where governments say, oh, no, we definitely don't support this conflict, but we're good with selling weapons to the people involved in it. You know, I mean, at some point, Hollywood will write a film about that.
Pippa, something that you've said in past interviews has been that you really see a lot of upside potential for the stock market. And at the time, I remember being quite skeptical myself because I was convinced a recession is coming. So far, the market has agreed with you. Now, in light of this situation that looks like it could be the beginning of something potentially pretty big, does that change your outlook? Do you become bearish on the market? Or what do you think, given everything that's going on?
Yeah. So, yeah, just to put it in perspective, I've been forcefully bullish, let's put it that way, really over the last 5 years. So it's been a hard and long fought position. And I really appreciate that I may be the last person on the planet who has this view. But I still don't see any particular threat that topples it all down. And we've gotten a lot of bad news. You know, we've had the news that China is growing more slowly than we thought. We've had a lot of bad news about Silicon Valley and threats to the future of the big unicorns from Uber to Facebook to, you know, all of them. We've had quite bad news about deterioration of geopolitics in the Middle East, especially between Saudis and most of their neighbors except Israel. It's kind of like, you know, even more recently, we had the announcement that, you know, Porsche has come out with its electric car. And I think that probably the market for a Porsche electric car is a lot bigger than the one for a Tesla. So that's a big hit to Tesla that, you know, it was a race and now their competitors are catching up. But the market doesn't really blow up. So why is that? I think it's partly because there's still so much money in the system. And every time there's a downward price movement, everybody's ready to pile in. It's partly because of the view that if, you know, one company fails, another one will succeed. If Elon Musk and his efforts at Tesla don't work, no problem. We'll just invest in Porsche. You know, the market will just move very rapidly to whoever's got the innovation lead. And finally, in terms of military conflict, until we see something that's even more demanding than anything we've seen in the last decade, I don't think the markets are going to react that much. And even then, let's face it, look at what happened on the night that the Gulf War broke out, right? First, the markets tanked, and then they soared. You know, we ended up, remember the oil price was all over the place that day because people were trying to figure out what's the end impact. And in the end, the oil price ended up falling. Anyway, I'm just saying the bottom line is markets can discount very aggressively a bad outcome, but it doesn't last very long. And I think that's still true.
Okay, Pippa, let's talk then about some of the signals that we're seeing, because certainly the stock market's agreeing with you, despite my skepticism and that of many others. There's been a little bit of a pullback in the last couple of days, but considering that a war is maybe starting, it's not much of a move, and I'm sure that that will end up retracing. What about the bond market? We've seen yield curve inversion. We were seeing just crashing bond yields. Now, that's changed in the last couple of weeks, but so far it hasn't moved enough to really signal a reversal of trend. It may be just a correction in what has been perhaps an overextended move. So what do we make of what seem to be recession signals on the horizon, given the outlook that you have?
Well, let me tell you something really funny. You know how I'm always interested in signals and signals from all sorts of different parts of the economy. And one area that I like to keep an eye on is fashion. And people are like, oh, this is, you know, this can't be serious, really. And I'm like, well, it's just interesting because fashion people are artists, and artists always have an extraordinary ability to kind of detect the zeitgeist and to understand what's going on out there. And I saw a really interesting fashion signal recently, just in the last couple of weeks, which is a pair of jeans for women, blue jeans, that are one leg is a wide leg, like 1970s style wide leg, and the other leg is a skinny jean. And I'm like, if this is not the ultimate hedge, I don't know what is. Like, you know, it's so interesting that what you see are visual signals of people wanting to hedge. They're like, well, I don't know, it could go either way. Now, as long as you have that view of it could go either way, this is, to me, kind of encouraging. There's a hope that underpins that sort of a view. The view that we're definitely going into recession, which I, by the way, hear mainly from people who work on trading floors. And I do not hear that from people in the real economy. People in the real economy are working so hard, they can hardly keep up. They are raising money. They're getting deals done. Okay, it's not raising the money, let's say, for the WeWorks of this world. But that was kind of, I mean, it was over the top how that happened, and everybody agreed that too much money went in and there wasn't sufficient performance to justify it. But more broadly, if a company's got a good idea, they're not finding it hard to raise the capital and then build the business. So when I look across the board, what I see are lots of signals that the real economy is finding a way to hedge their bets, and the real economy is finding ways to progress no matter how bad the news gets. And this encourages me enormously about where we're going. The other thing is the conflicting signals about the markets, you know, the stock market at nearly all-time highs and the bond market going in a negative territory. The bottom line is nothing will stimulate the stock market like negative interest rates. I mean, negative interest rates are a total buy signal for equities because, number one, it's inflationary. Number two, you got to get performance if you're a pension fund or you're a sovereign wealth fund. You can't, you know, do nothing. And so given a choice, you're now looking to be in growth companies. And that's what I see is people are rotating into equities, not out of them, as a result of bond yields going so low that you practically have to pay the government to borrow their money, which, of course, doesn't make any sense.
Well, Pippa, that may be coming. We've already got negative interest rates in Europe, but we're going to need to leave it here in the interest of time. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners, you're such a fascinating person to interview, for our listeners that want to find out more about you, all of the excellent books that you've written, including Best Business Book of the Year last year. Congratulations on that title. What's your Twitter handle, and where can people learn more about what you do?
Sure. So it's at Dr. Pippa M, because nobody can spell Malmgren. It's a Swedish name. And yeah, I'm on Twitter. I have to say I've been a little bit quiet lately because I'm deep into writing my next book, which is about drones and data and digitization. But I will jump back on there and say hello to anybody who wants to have a conversation about what's going on in the world.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait to do a full-length interview on your new book when you get closer to publishing it. In the meantime, we're going to let you go in the interest of time. Folks, stay tuned. We've got a really fantastic lineup coming up for you this week on Macro Voices. We've still got Alex Gurevich and Julian Brigden coming up on All Stars. We're also going to finally be back with our Energy Week format this week. And we've got Gluskin Chef, Chief Economist David Rosenberg lined up for the Thursday night Macro Voices podcast. So keep it tuned to Macro Voices for some really fantastic content. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.